Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and joining me now on the increasingly aggressive campaign to abolish abortion rights, given Alabama and the other recent state laws, is Rebecca Traister, writer-at-large for New York Magazine, and the author of, most recently, Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. Her latest article in New York Magazine is titled, Our Fury Over Abortion Was Dismissed for Decades as Hysterical, But We Were Gaslit. Rebecca, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Gaslit, how?
Well, told that for decades, there have been activists who've been furious, basically ever since Roe was decided. The anti-abortion movement has worked to roll back access. And that, you know, the biggest sort of stage of that was the passage of the Hyde Amendment in 1976, which forbid federal insurance money to be used to pay for abortions, which basically cut off low-income women, predominantly women of color, from access to the health care that was their legal right. People have been screaming about that for years. There are all these what you'll often hear described as the chipping away state laws, trap laws that insisted that clinics meet certain specifications, and many of them were forced to close. Waiting periods, restrictions, parental consent that made abortion ever harder to obtain, especially for those who perhaps were in most need, low-income women, young women. And people have been yelling about this for years, and we have been told, I have been told, activists have been told over and over again by those, whether it's socially or politically, that these fears are overdramatic and overblown, and this is a sort of single-issue whining, and Roe's going to remain the law of the land, and it's settled case law, and nothing's going to happen to it. But part of the point that I want to make is it's not even just about whether Roe gets overturned. It's the fact that ever since abortion was made legal, it has become ever more inaccessible to the people who need to access it as part of comprehensive health care.
And we were all thinking about your book, meaning, you know, my team in the office here, your book, Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger, in the last few days since the Alabama law was passed, where, you know, we could talk about the legal nuances and whether Brett Kavanaugh is likely to uphold this mm-hmm. aspect or that aspect, but really just so many women, especially right now, just want to scream.
Right. Well, and they should, but the point is, a lot of people should have been screaming much earlier. And you know who was screaming and where anger was effective was on the anti-abortion side. As soon as, and that's part of, you know, I write in my book is largely about progressive anger, anger at gendered and racial and economic inequality from a sort of politically progressive standpoint. But I also write in that book about the power of anger unleashed by those on the right, sort of in favor of a patriarchal white capitalist power structure. That anger is potent too. And that has been the anger that has motivated so many of the activists who've been pushing these anti-abortion measures in states and nationally. And that anger has worked for them.
One thing that you write in your New York Magazine article is that your rage stems in part from dynasties of white men united in their dedication to restricting women's bodily autonomy, but they include Democrats.
Oh, they absolutely include Democrats. I've been raging at the Democratic Party about abortion, you know, since I was a child, in part, as I write in my piece, because I grew up in Pennsylvania, where Bob Casey Sr. was the governor, and he was virulently anti-abortion. His son, Bob Casey Jr., is now senior senator in Pennsylvania. He is better than his father was. He has sort of evolved, as they say, and he's gotten better, but he still voted for a 20-week ban last year in his role as a senator. But this is a whole generation of Democratic politics, especially in the wake of Roe. And actually, I think in the wake of a lot of the transformative social movements, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the gay rights movement, the Democratic Party, which stood theoretically for those politics, was very scared of its role in aggressively standing up for those rights. And And there was a period of several decades where a lot of the guys that they hired were these middle-of-the-road, anti-choice Democrats. And it happened. It's the 70s, it's the 80s. This is Joe Biden. Joe Biden voted for that Hyde Amendment in the 70s and remained anti-abortion for much of his career in the Senate. It's only recently that he has gotten better on abortion. But he wasn't alone either. It was the Casey's. Harry Reid was personally anti-abortion. There was, and up until, you know, in 2006, Rahm Emanuel, as he was running the Democrats, you know, 50-state strategy to put together a Democratic House, advocated a big tent where we invite anti-abortion Democrats in so that we can get a Democratic majority. Right. But then we have a Democratic majority with a strong anti-abortion contingent. And in fact, that had an impact. We had the Democratic majority in the House after 2006, but it was anti-abortion Democrats who held up health care reform in 2009 and 2010 by insisting that healthcare not pay for abortions. So terrific, we have our Democratic majority, but it's still held up keeping women from getting the access to the healthcare that they need.
It was anti-abortion Democrats who did that?
It was Bart Stupak, Ben Nelson. Democrats, anti-abortion Democrats who stalled the passage of that was, you know, they weren't the majority of the Democratic Party, but they held it up to a sort of crisis point and putting women in a terrible position. Wait, are you going to stand in the way of healthcare reform? Not just women, but women and men who support access to abortion and the full range of reproductive healthcare.
Is that fight over now?
No.
Is there basically no place in the Democratic Party for anti-choice people?
Absolutely not. That fight is not over. In 2017, in the wake of the 2016 election, Tom Perez, the head of the DNC, and Bernie Sanders went on a unity tour where they spoke about the need to create a big tent and how this couldn't be a litmus test. Nancy Pelosi has said the same thing. It is still an active conversation. There is still the view in the Democratic Party that the issue we can sort of trade off on in order to get purportedly more moderate, you know, regions to vote for Democrats is abortion. Now, A, why is it always abortion the thing that can trade? B, this is bad science because, in fact, what used to happen, we used to poll on abortion one way, which is asking people, hey, are you pro or anti, right? Are you for abortion or against abortion? And when you polled that way, which is how it was done for decades, you got a pretty 50-50 split, which led to this received wisdom that the country is irrevocably split in half on abortion. And so then by those numbers, okay, so here and there you give. But in fact, in recent years, they have gotten better at polling and they start polling in a different way. And they ask first, are you personally in favor of abortion? And many people say no. And then you say, do you want abortion to remain legal? And what you get when you ask it in that two-question way is a 70% number on who want it to remain legal. It is one of the most popular positions the Democrats stand for. And yet there is this old unwillingness to aggressively stand behind it.
Listeners, we can take your phone calls for Rebecca Traister from New York Magazine. Maybe you saw her new piece, Our Fury Over Abortion Was Dismissed for Decades as Hysterical, But We Were Gaslit. Maybe talk about your own fury that was written off as hysterical. Maybe you want to talk about your own feeling of having been gaslit or anything else. 212-433-WNYC in light of Alabama and the other things going on. 212-433-9692. What about the gender divide or lack of divide in the polls? Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that? I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but it's a lot closer than one might guess between men and women.
You mean
women
and
right?
men who are pro and anti-abortion specifically?
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Right.
It's much more of a political division. But again, I would have to look at the sort of better polling for the gender divide. I don't know how that works when you look at those polls that are producing an entirely different set of numbers. Yes, but for years, it's been that men and women are divided. But that, in certain ways, mirrors our partisan politics. Again, we talk a lot about the 53% of white women who
voted for Trump.
Who voted for Trump, and in fact, a majority of white women have voted Republican since they've been keeping track of this, and certainly before they've been keeping track of it, with one exception, the 1992 presidential election.
So that's a lot of anti-abortion rights women.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's part of what I was saying before, that what you're talking about, women who are willing to be angry on behalf of fundamentally patriarchal policies are very useful to those power, to the people in power and who want to keep a grasp on patriarchal and white patriarchal power, because those women do the work of giving voice to that fury as women. And that is a tremendously useful role for them. And of course, many of them passionately believe what they're angry about.
Anna in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Rebecca Traister. Hi, Anna.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. One thing that struck me, first of all, Brian, earlier today when you were talking about the distinction between the several of the recent laws that have been passed, mm-hmm. is the discussion around whether or not these laws include exceptions for rape and incest. And to me, and I, you know, obviously this has been sort of in the discussion around abortion for years, you know, even if you oppose it, should there be an exception for rape and incest? And to me, this crystallizes what this debate is actually about. Because for people, I say this not believing it, but knowing Catholics who, I think, and other people who firmly believe that truly abortion is murder. Okay, so if that's your starting point, why would the method of pregnancy make any difference? And so if it does make a difference, then there's a different starting point. And the starting point is actually about controlling women's bodies and punishing women for the choices they make. And I almost find it more infuriating when people say, like, well, you know, if it's not your fault that you're in this situation, well, maybe we can make an exception. But, like, I don't know, it's the whole thing's infuriating, but I feel like that point gets missed sometimes. So thanks for letting me share it.
Thank you very much, Rebecca.
I think that's a fascinating point. And the places where the logical fallacies, like the one that you point out, come in are just so glaring. I mean, and this is part of what a reproductive justice movement led by women of color for years has been pointing out, that among other things, the whole notion of choice, which has been the construct that that part of an abortion and reproductive rights movement has used, and I've always thought it was not a complete construct. Anyway, but the reproductive justice has been pointing out, if you have legislators who are legislating limitation on women's reproductive control and rooted in this idea that it's on behalf of the life and well-being of an unborn child, and yet not offering the kinds of housing and education and access to birth control and other kinds of health care that would, in fact, ensure that that future child has a safe life, then where you have a complete breakdown of logic right there. But that is the political reality. I would also point out that, you know, the notion that Democrats and Republicans feel one way or the other about abortion is relatively new. Up until Roe was decided, you had Republicans very much on the side of access to abortion. And that is something that we have to remember when we sort this out. The Bush family was a huge supporter of Planned Parenthood. Ronald Reagan signed one of the most liberal abortion bills in California in its state's history, and then became a virulently anti-abortion president, because in part his presidency was built on the unifying of the moral majority and a religious right with economic conservatism. But this split sort of came in to replace some splits around race and segregation. But the partisan split on abortion is relatively new.
So it's almost like you're saying the way the conservative coalition formed since the 70s, it's like conservative America stands for, you know, protecting all Americans from conception all the way to birth.
Right. Yes. Yeah. I mean, and that's what does it even mean to advocate for the well-being of an unborn child for whom you then make no provisions for child care, for access to health care? This is a party that, you know, has fought against CHIP legislation that would provide health care access to children. What does it mean if they're not safe places and affordable places for those children to live and go to school? It is meaningless as a sort of moral imperative unless you are also voting for the kinds of legislation that actually provide resources for those children.
Susan in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Rebecca Traister. Hi.
Thank you, Brian. You're so great. And Ms. Traister, I'm just so thrilled that you're talking about this, because the thing you said about abortion being kind of a pawn, like, well, okay, we can have health care, but we cannot have, you know, choice or whatever. I mean, the point you made before. I was just wondering if you could discuss the terms pro-life, which I think is a horrible, ridiculous, and false claim, expression, in terms of choice and anti-choice. Mm. Like, that was co-opted. So if people are against abortion, they're suddenly pro-life. You know, could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, this is an argument that I think I've been making for a while, and more, far more importantly, as I mentioned before, reproductive justice advocates have been making, which is that there was this co-optation of language in the wake of the Roe decision, where anti-abortion advocates, like, gobbled up this language of life and morality and family. Now, to my mind, first of all, reproductive rights advocates could have taken that same language and, you know, made the moral argument, which I fully believe in, the moral argument on behalf of life, family, the well-being of human beings, on the side of full reproductive access. The reproductive justice movement itself criticizes the language of choice, again, as being about what does choice even mean in communities. And again, reproductive justice movement is led by women of color who have had other kinds of reproductive control, have faced, you know, involuntary sterilization, lack of access to basic obstetric and gynecological care. Black women have sky-high mortality rates at this point. And so for them, choice doesn't even figure. For the reproductive justice movement, choice is sort of meaningless if there aren't choices about if you can have a family and if you can have a safe community in which to raise that family and well-funded schools and affordable housing. And so choice is a little empty from that angle too. And I would have preferred a reproductive rights movement to be more aggressive in its language about the full spectrum, and that is what the reproductive justice movement does.
And even further to that point, and Susan, thank you so much for your call, I saw that you recently tweeted about Alyssa Milano's recent appearance on Chris Cuomo's primetime show on CNN, where she said, "Nobody wants to get an abortion. We are all pro-life, but there are circumstances that we cannot avoid," unquote, which is a very common narrative that all abortions are difficult decisions and heavy burdens on women. The state shouldn't impose their opinion on them. So, but you, that's not good enough for you.
No, it's not good enough because, again, it seeds the notion of morality. It behaves as though this cornerstone of comprehensive health care is, in fact, something to be avoided or that everybody feels regret about. There are a lot of people who feel enormous relief if they can have access to abortion. There are millions of women who cannot access this kind of care that they require for their lives, for their well-being, for the well-being of their family. And so the notion that abortion is always that not everybody feels bad about having an abortion. And I do think we need to be more aggressive and assertive in pointing that out and not run away from people who want to make this counter argument. We have to, one of the things we have to do is assert that the life of the person who requires this care has moral value and agency on its own. And that is where I guess choice comes in, you know, that these are human, that women and people with uteruses who need to get an abortion are people with brains and hearts and families and morality of their own. And we cannot, this has been a habit again in sort of retreating from an aggressive defense of reproductive health care. And it's a Clintonian formulation, safe, legal, and rare. We want, John Kerry has said it, we want to make abortion the rarest thing in the world. No, we need to treat abortion as if it is part of health care because it is.
Celeste in Croton on Hudson. You're on WNYC with Rebecca Traister. Hi, Celeste.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just want to mention that a great way for people to express their outrage over these abortion bans is to show up tomorrow afternoon in Foley Square at 5:30, where there will be a rally sponsored by the National Institute for Reproductive Health and Planned Parenthood. Although, thanks to the passage of the RHA in New York State, which only happened because we managed to get a Democratic majority in the Senate.
Reproductive Health Act.
So we're okay in New York at this point in time, but that could change. And we also need to stand in solidarity with the people in other states who are really being, whose rights are really being, devastated at this point.
Celeste, thank you.
Celeste, I'm so glad that you made that point about, yes, the laws in New York have just recently become strengthened after years of angry and energetic activism by people who were pushing for this. The Reproductive Health Act was passed. But I'm so glad that you make the point that we have to go beyond what's going to happen to us, because this has been one of, I think, the places where our outrage has been quelled to perilous effect. We have been told over and over again, various people in California, in New York, oh, you're going to be fine. It's going to be fine. It doesn't matter if people in vast swaths of the rest of the country do not have the same access. And for all intents and purposes, in many states, Roe might not even exist. There are too few or no clinics, too few or no doctors, outrageous costs for people who don't necessarily have the money, and that those costs only go up when you talk about having to travel great distances to find a clinic or stay overnight because of you need a waiting period and you have to pay for health care, you have to pay for child care for children back home. Those costs become impossible. It forces later and later. You save up money and you get further along in your pregnancy and you get to another stage in your pregnancy where then you have new kinds of bans and restrictions. This process has been going on for decades. And so it doesn't matter if we're okay in New York.
We only have a minute left, but I wonder sometimes if religious liberty couldn't be used as an argument to preserve legal abortion. It's all this 14th Amendment stuff and privacy and equal protection. But I mean, I grew up in Reform Judaism, which, unless they've changed it very recently, takes a position as the largest branch of Judaism in the United States that it's pro-abortion rights. There are other mainline Protestant religions that take that position too. So it's like, who are the Mike Pences of the world to decide that they can use state power to impose their religion on Reform Jews and everybody else?
I think that's a fascinating and creative idea. And I want to point out that even, you know, Catholics for a Free Choice, there are religious groups even coming from religions that are anti-abortion. Catholics for a Free Choice has done remarkable, active, energetic work for a long time to maintain reproductive access and healthcare and access to abortion. And so I do think that probably people from religious communities could come from other angles and be leaders in this fight.
Rebecca Traister, the writer at large for New York Magazine. Her new piece is "Our Fury Over Abortion Was Dismissed for Decades as Hysterical, But We Were Gaslit." Her book is "Good and Mad: The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger." Rebecca, thank you so much.
Thank you.